2 weeks later, Dr. Wellington Yue arrived from Richies, accompanied by his cyborg development team of 24 men and women, and 2 shuttle loads of medical equipment and supplies. Duke Leto Atreides personally supervised as his men helped the party disembark. Fussy about details, the stylus-thin Yue barely took time to introduce himself before he scurried about the spaceport, attending to the arriving cargo cases of instruments and the prosthetic parts that would ultimately be fitted onto Romber's salvageable flesh and bones. Ground trucks transported personnel and cargo to the infirmary center, where Yue insisted upon seeing the patient immediately. The Sook doctor looked over at Leto as they entered the hospital. "I will make him whole again, sir, though it will take some time for him to get used to his new body. Romber will do everything you ask." Inside the room, Tesha still had not left Romber's side. Yue moved smoothly over to the life support pod, studied connections, diagnostic readings. Then he looked down at the injured prince, who regarded him with his bizarre single eye, set in grossly wounded flesh. "Prepare yourself, Romber Vernius," Yue said, stroking his long mustaches. "I intend to begin the first surgical procedure tomorrow." Romber's synthetic voice floated across the room, smoother now that he had practiced using it. "I look forward to shaking your hand." Love is an ancient force, one that served its purpose in its day, but is no longer essential for the survival of the species. Bene Gesserit axiom. Looking down from the sea cliff, Leto saw the house guard arrayed on the beach where he had ordered them to take up positions. He had given them no reason. Concerned about the Duke's mental state, Gurney, Thufir, and Duncan had been watching him like Atreides' hawks, but Leto knew how to sidetrack them. The golden sun rode high overhead in a clear blue sky, yet still a shadow hung over him. The Duke wore a short-sleeved white tunic and blue dungarees, comfortable clothes with no trappings of his office. He drew a deep breath and stared. Maybe he could just be a man for a short while. Jessica hurried up behind him, wearing a low-cut aqua single suit.
"What are you thinking, my lord?"
Her face showed deep concern, as if she feared he might jump to his death, as Kailia had done. Perhaps Hawat had sent her up here to check on him. Seeing the grouped men on the beach, Leto gave a wan smile. No doubt they would try to catch him in their own arms if he tumbled off the cliff. "I am distracting the men so I can get away." He looked at her oval face. With her Bene Gesserit training, Jessica would not be so easily fooled. And he knew better than to try. "I've had enough talk, advice, and pressure. I need to escape to where I can have peace." She touched his arm. "If I don't preoccupy them," he said, "they will insist upon sending a retinue of guards to accompany me." Below, Duncan Idaho began to drill the troops in techniques he had learned at the Ginaz school. Leto turned from the view. "Now perhaps I can get away."
"Oh? Where are we going?" Jessica asked, fully confident.
Leto frowned at her, but she cut him off before he could object to her presence.
"My lord, I will not allow you to go alone. Would you rather have the full complement of guards, or just me?"
He considered her words and, with a sigh, gestured toward the green-roofed thopter hangars at the edge of the nearby landing fields. "I suppose you're less objectionable than an entire army." Jessica followed as he crossed the dry grasses. Grief still radiated from him in waves. That he'd even considered the foul price demanded by the Tleilaxu in exchange for a gola of Victor showed her how close to the edge of madness he had gone. But in the end, Leto had made the right decision. She hoped it was his first step toward healing. Inside the hangar building were a number of ornithopters, some with engine covers open. Mechanics stood on suspensor platforms working on them. Leto walked purposefully to an emerald-hulled thopter with red Atreides hawks on the undersides of the wings. Built low to the ground,
It had a two-seat cockpit and a front-back arrangement instead of the standard face-front or side-by-side configurations. A man in gray coveralls had his head inside the engine compartment, but emerged when the Duke approached. "Just a couple of final adjustments, my lord." He had a shaved upper lip and a silver-flecked beard encircled his face, giving him a simian appearance. "Thank you, Kino." Distracted, Leto stroked the side of the sleek vessel. "My father's racing thopter," he said to Jessica. "He called it Greenhawk. I trained on her, went out with him and did loops, dives, and rolls." He allowed himself a bittersweet smile. "Used to drive Thufir crazy, seeing the Duke and his only heir taking such risks. I think my father did it just to irritate him." Jessica examined the unusual craft. Its wings were narrow and upswept, with the nose split into two aerodynamic sections. The mechanic finished his adjustments and closed the engine cover. "All ready to go, sir." After helping Jessica into the rear-facing seat, Duke Leto climbed into the front. A safety harness snicked into place over her lap, another over his own. Turbines hissed on, and he taxied the sleek aircraft out of the hangar onto a broad ochre tarmac. Kino waved after them. Warm wind whipped through Jessica's hair until the Plexplaz cockpit cover slid shut. Leto touched the controls, working busily, expertly, intent on prepping the thopter, ignoring Jessica. The green wings shortened for jet boost takeoff, their delicate interleavings meshing together. The turbines roared, and the craft launched straight up. Extending the wings to beetle stubs, Leto banked sharply to the left, then low over the beach, where his soldiers waited in formation. With startled faces, they looked up as the Duke flew by, dipping the wings. "They'll see us flying north along the coastline," Leto shouted back to Jessica. "But after we're out of sight, we'll go west. They won't be able to follow us." "We'll be alone." Jessica hoped the Duke's mood would improve with this sojourn into the wilderness, but she would stay by him regardless. "I always feel alone," Leto answered. The ornithopter turned, crossed over Pundi Rice lowlands and small farm buildings. The wings extended to full soaring length and began to beat like the appendages of a great bird. Below them were river orchards, the narrow Siubi River, and a modest mountain of the same name, the highest point on the plain. They flew west all afternoon without seeing another aircraft. The landscape changed, becoming more rugged and mountainous. After sighting a village by an alpine lake, Leto studied the instruments and changed his heading. Soon the mountains gave way to grassy plains and sheer canyons. Presently, Leto stubbed the wings and banked hard right to descend into a deep river gorge. "Agamemnon Canyon," Leto said. "See the terraces?" He pointed to one side. "They were built by ancient Caledonian primitives, whose descendants still live here. They're rarely seen by outsiders." Observing intently, Jessica spotted a brown-skinned man with a narrow, dark face before he ducked out of sight into a rock hollow. Leto steered away from the cliff face and continued down, toward a broad river with surging white water. In the waning daylight, they flew low over the rushing current, through the narrow, winding gorge. "It's beautiful," Jessica said. In an offshoot canyon, the river dwindled, leaving creamy sand beaches. Wings fully tucked, the ornithopter set down on a bank of sand with a soft lurch. "My father and I used to come fishing here." Leto opened a hatch on the side of the thopter and brought out a spacious auto tent, which set itself up and shot stabilizing stakes into the sand. They set up an air pad and a double sleeping envelope and brought their luggage and food packs in. For a while they sat together on the riverbank and talked, while the shadows of late afternoon settled over the gorge and the temperature dropped. They snuggled closer, and Jessica leaned her bronze hair into the side of his neck. Large fish jumped while swimming upstream, against the current. Leto maintained his somber silence, causing her to pull back and look into his smoky gray eyes. Feeling the muscles in his hand tighten up, she leaned close, gave him a long kiss. Against her explicit training in the sisterhood, all the lectures Mohiam had given her, Jessica found herself breaking one of the primary rules of the Bene Gesserit. Despite her intentions, despite her loyalty to the sisterhood, Jessica had actually allowed herself to fall in love with this man. They held each other, and for a long while Leto gazed out onto the river. "I still have nightmares," he said. "I see Victor, Romber, the flames." He pressed his face into his hands. "I thought I could escape the ghosts by coming way out here." He looked at her, his expression bleak. "I shouldn't have allowed you to come with me." Wind gusts began to whip through the narrow canyon, snapping the tent fabric, and knotted clouds crawled overhead. "We'd better get inside before the storm comes." He hurried over to close the thopter hatch, and just as he returned, a hard rain began to fall. He barely escaped getting drenched. They shared a warm food pack inside the tent, and later, when Leto lay back on the double sleeping pad, still troubled, Jessica moved close and began kissing his neck. Outside, the storm grew louder, more demanding of their attention. The tent flapped and rattled, but Jessica felt safe and warm. As they made love that stormy night, Leto clung to her like a drowning man grasping a life raft, hoping to find some island of safety in a hurricane. Jessica responded to his desperation, afraid of his intensity, hardly able to cope with his outpouring of love. He was like a storm himself, uncontrolled and elemental. The sisterhood had never taught her about anything like this. Emotionally torn but determined, Jessica finally gave Leto the most precious gift she had left to offer. Manipulating her own body chemistry in the Bene Gesserit way, she envisioned his sperm and her egg merging, and allowed herself to conceive a child. Though she had been given explicit instructions from the sisterhood to produce only a daughter, Jessica had delayed and reconsidered, spending month after month contemplating this most important of decisions. Through it all, she came to the realization that she could no longer bear to watch Leto's anguish. She had to do this one thing for him. Duke Leto Atreides would have another son. "How will I be remembered by my children? This is the true measure of a man." Abelard Harkonnen. Within sight of the Baron's square-walled keep, the industrial float craft rose high in the gloomy sky. Inside the float craft's large cargo hold, directly over its gaping open hatch, Glossu Raban hung spread-eagled. Shackles secured his wrists and ankles, but little else kept him from falling into the open sore of Harko City. His blue uniform was torn, his face bruised and bloodied from the scuffle with Captain Kriubi's troopers when they'd subdued him, pursuant to the Baron's orders. It had taken 6 or 7 of the burliest guards to control the beast, and they had not been gentle. Now, on chains, the brutish man thrashed from side to side, looking for something to bite, something to spit at. Steadying himself against a rail while the wind whipped up through the yawning hatch, Baron Harkonnen gazed dispassionately down at his nephew. The obese Baron's spider-black eyes were like deep holes. "Did I give you permission to kill my brother, Raban?"
"He was only your half-brother, Uncle. He was a fool! I thought we would be better off."
"Don't try to do any thinking, Glossu. You aren't good at it. Answer my question. Did I give you permission to kill a member of the Harkonnen family?" When the response didn't come quickly enough, the Baron moved a lever on a control panel. The shackle on Raban's left ankle sprang open, leaving the leg to dangle out over open space. Raban writhed and screamed, unable to do anything. The Baron found the technique a primitive but effective method of increasing fear.
No, Uncle, I did not have your permission.
No what?
No, Uncle. I mean, no, my lord.
The blocky man grimaced in pain while he struggled for the correct words, trying to understand what his uncle wanted. The Baron spoke into a comm unit to the float craft operator.
Take us over my keep and hover 50 meters above the terrace. I think the cactus garden there could use some fertilizer.
Looking up with a pitiful expression, Raban declared, I killed my father because he was a weakling. All his life his actions brought dishonor on House Harkonnen.
Abelard wasn't strong, you mean? Not like you and me?
No, my lord Baron. He didn't measure up to our standards.
So now you have decided to call yourself Beast, is that correct?
Yes, yes, my lord.
Through the open hatch, Baron Harkonnen could see the keep's spires. Directly below them was a garden terrace where he sometimes liked to sit and eat sumptuous meals in privacy, in the midst of the spiny desert growths.
If you look below, Raban...
Yes, I believe you have a good view now. You can see a certain modification I made to the garden earlier today.
As he spoke, the metal tips of army lances emerged from the dirt beside Thorn Saguaro and Chocatilla.
See what I planted for you?
Dangling from the three remaining shackles, Raban twisted to look, his face filled with terror.
Note the bull's-eye arrangement of the tips. If I drop you just right, you will be impaled in the exact center. If I miss by a little, we can still earn points for the hit, since every lance has a scoring number written on it.
He stroked his upper lip.
Perhaps we can even introduce slave dropping as an event for our arena crowds. Quite an exciting concept, don't you think? My lord, please don't do this. You need me.
With emotionless eyes, the Baron looked down at him.
Why? I have your little brother, Faedraltha. Perhaps I'll make him my heir designate. By the time he's your age, he certainly won't make as many mistakes as you have. Uncle, please! You must learn to pay close attention to what I say at all times. Beast, I never make idle chatter.
Raban squirmed and the chains jingled. Cold, smoky air drifted into the float craft as he tried desperately to think of what to say.
You want to know if it's a good game? My lord, it's most ingenious.
So I'm a smart man to devise it? Much smarter than you, correct?
Infinitely smarter.
Then don't ever try to oppose me. Is that understood? I'll always be 10 steps ahead of you, ready with surprises that you could never imagine.
I understand, my lord.
Relishing the abject terror he saw in his nephew's face, the Baron said, Very well, I shall release you now.
Wait, Uncle!
The Baron touched a button on the control panel, and both arm shackles opened, so that Raban dropped upside down into open air, held by only the right ankle band.
Oops! Do you think I hit the wrong button?
Screaming,
No! You're teaching me a lesson!
And have you learned that lesson?
Yes, Uncle! Let me come back! I will always do what you say!
Into the comm unit, the Baron said, Take us to my private lake. The float craft glided over the estate until it was directly over the grimy waters of a man-made pond. Following previous orders, the operator descended to 10 meters over the water. Seeing what lay in store for him, Raban tried to pull himself up by the single shackle.
This isn't necessary, Uncle. I've learned...
The rest of Raban's words were lost in a clatter of chain as the remaining shackle was released. The burly man fell, flailing and screaming, a long way down into the water.
I don't think I've ever had the opportunity to ask,
the Baron shouted through the opening as Raban went under.
Can you swim?
Kriubi's men were stationed around the lake with rescue equipment, just in case. After all, the Baron couldn't risk the life of his only trained heir. Though he would never admit it to Raban, he was actually pleased at the loss of Bleeding Heart Abelard. It took guts to do what he had done to his own father. Guts and ruthlessness. Good Harkonnen traits. But I'm even more ruthless, the Baron thought as the float craft glided back to its landing field. I've just demonstrated that to keep him from trying to kill me. Beast Raban must prey only on the weak, and only when I say so. Still, the Baron faced a much greater challenge. His body continued to decline each day. He'd been taking imported energy supplements, and they helped to keep the weakness and bloating in check. But it was becoming necessary to consume more and more pills to achieve the same benefit, with unknown side effects. The Baron sighed. It was so difficult to medicate himself, when there weren't any good doctors around. How many had he killed now for their incompetence? He'd lost count. Some say that the anticipation of a thing is better than the thing itself. In my view, this is utter nonsense. Any fool can imagine a prize. I desire the tangible. Hasimir Fenring, Letters from Arrakis. The confidential message came to the residency at Arrakeen via a tortuous route from one courier to another, highliner to highliner. As if Master Researcher Hidar Fenajidika wanted to delay delivering the news to Hasimir Fenring. Very odd, since the Tleilaxu had already delayed for 20 years. Eager to read the contents of the cylinder, already planning a series of punishments if Ajitika dared to make more excuses, Fenring scuttled to his private study dome on the rooftop level of the mansion. What whining lies will that little gnome tell now? Behind shimmering shield windows that dulled the harsh edges of sunlight, Fenring went through the tedious process of decoding the message, humming to himself all the while. The courier cylinder had been genetically keyed to his touch alone. Such a sophisticated technique that he wondered if the Tleilaxu were showing off their abilities for him. The little men were not incompetent, merely annoying. He expected the letter to be filled with further requests for laboratory materials, more empty promises. Even decoded, the words made no sense, and Fenring saw that they were masked by a secondary encryption. He felt a flash of impatience, then spent 10 more minutes stroking the words again. As the true text finally emerged, Fenring stared with his overlarge eyes. He blinked twice, then read Ajitika's note again. Astounding! His guard chief, Willowbrook, appeared at the doorway, curious about the important delivery. He was aware of the Count's frequent plots and secret work for Shaddam IV, but knew not to ask too many questions. "Would you like me to summon a light lunch, Master Fenring?"
"Go away,"
Fenring said without looking over his shoulder, "or I will have you assigned to the Harkonnen headquarters in Carthag." Willowbrook left promptly. Fenring sat back with the message in his hands, flash memorized every word, and then destroyed the tough paper. He would very much enjoy relaying the news to the Emperor. At last, his thin lips curled in a smile. Even before the death of Shaddam's father, this plan had been set in motion. Now, after decades, that work had finally come to fruition. "Count Fenring, we are pleased to report that the final sequence of development appears to meet our expectations. We are confident that Project Amal has succeeded, and the next round of rigorous tests will prove it. We expect to go into full-scale production within a few months. Soon, the Emperor will have his own inexpensive and inexhaustible supply of melange, a new monopoly that will place the great powers of the Imperium at his feet. All spice harvesting operations on Arrakis will become irrelevant." Trying to suppress his satisfied grin, Fenring stepped to the window and gazed out onto the dusty streets of Arrakeen, at the impossible aridity and heat. In the masses of people, he picked out blue-uniformed Harkonnen troops, brightly attired water merchants and grimy spice crews, haughty preachers and ragged beggars, an economy based solely on one commodity, spice. Soon none of that would matter to anyone. Arrakis and natural melange would become an obsolete historical curiosity. No one would care about this desert planet anymore.
and he could move on to other, more important things. Penring drew a long, deep breath. It would be good to get off this rock. Though death will cancel it, life in this world is a glorious thing. Duke Paulus Atreides. The Last Chapter. A man should not have to attend the funeral of his own child. Standing erect on the bow of the Atreides funeral barge, Duke Leto wore a formal white uniform, stripped of all insignia to symbolize the loss of his only son. At his side, Jessica had draped herself in a black Bene Gesserit robe, but it could not hide her beauty. Behind them, a cortege of boats followed the funeral barge, all of them decked in colorful flowers and ribbons to celebrate the life of a boy whose days had been cut tragically short. Atreides soldiers lined the decks of the escort boats, holding ceremonial metal shields that flashed when the sun broke through the cloud-scudded sky. Sadly, Leto gazed past the gilded hawk prow, shading his eyes to look across the waters of Caladan. Victor had loved the oceans. In the distance, where the sea faded into the curved horizon, Leto saw flickering storms and bright sky sparkles. Perhaps a congregation of Elecrans come to usher the lad's soul to a new place beneath the waves. For generations of Atreides, life itself had been revered as the ultimate blessing. The Atreides counted what a man did when he was alive. Events he could experience with clarity and enjoy with all of his senses. A person's accomplishments held far more significance than any shadowy afterlife. The tangible was more important than the intangible. Oh, how I miss you, my son. In the brief years he had shared with Victor, he'd tried to instill strength in the boy, just as his own father had done for him. Each person must have the ability to rely on himself, to help his comrades, but never to lean on them too much. I need all my strength today. A man should not have to attend the funeral of his own child. The natural order had been disrupted. Though Kylea had not been his wife, and Victor had not been the official ducal heir, Leto could not think of a more terrible thing to befall a person. Why had he been the one to survive, the one to endure the knowing, the awful sense of loss? The cortege of boats set course for the coral gem beds far offshore, where Leto and Romber had gone diving years ago, where Leto would have taken his own son one day. But Victor hadn't been given enough time. Leto could never fulfill all the promises he'd made to the boy, both in words and in his heart. The Atreides funeral barge rose several tiers high, an impressive floating monument. On the top level, giant kabuzu shell cressets, 15 meters tall, burned whale oil. Up there, Victor's body lay in a golden coffin surrounded by his favorite things. A stuffed Seleucid bull toy, a feathered Vara lance with a rubber tip, film books, games, seashells he had collected from the shore. Representatives of many great houses had also sent wrapped gifts. The baubles and keepsakes nearly engulfed the child's tiny, preserved body. Bright flowers, green and black pennants, and long ribbons decorated the gilded tiers. Donated paintings and artists' renderings depicted a proud Duke Leto holding his newborn son high overhead, then later teaching the boy how to bullfight, fishing with him on one of the docks, protecting him from the attack of the Alacran. Other images showed Victor on his mother's lap, doing school lessons or running while holding a whistle kite by its string. And then, poignantly, several empty panels, left blank to represent what Victor had not done in his life and never would. Reaching the reefs, crewmen set anchors to keep the barge in place. The boats took up positions encircling the funeral barge. Duncan Idaho piloted a small motorboat around to the bow and tied up alongside. Atreides soldiers began clanging their ceremonial shields in a mounting crescendo that carried across the waves. Duke Atreides and Jessica stood together with their heads bowed. The brisk wind blew in their faces, stinging Leto's eyes, ruffling Jessica's dark robe. After a long moment, the Duke straightened and drew a deep breath of sea air to drive back a tide of tears. He looked up at the top level of the barge where his son lay. A shaft of bright sunlight flashed on the golden coffin. Slowly, Leto raised his hands to the heavens. The clashing of shields ceased, and a hush fell over the assemblage. Waves lapped against the boats, and far overhead a lone seabird called. The engine of Duncan Idaho's motorboat purred steadily. In one of the Duke's hands he held a transmitter, which he activated. The flaming cressets tipped in toward Victor and poured burning oil over his coffin. Within seconds the top level of the wooden barge caught on fire. Duncan helped Jessica into the motorboat, then Leto joined them. They untied from the funeral barge and drifted away as the roaring fire grew brighter and hotter. "It is done," Leto said, not taking his eyes from the flames while Duncan maneuvered the boat into position in the circle of larger boats. As the Duke watched his son's funeral pyre consume the entire barge in a splash of yellow and orange light, he murmured to Jessica, "I can never again think fondly of Kailia. Now you alone provide the strength I need to survive." He had already sent his regrets to Archduke Armand de Caz, declining the offer of marriage to his daughter Elisa, at least for the time being, and the Archduke had quietly withdrawn the offer. Deeply touched by his words, Jessica promised herself that she would never press Leto for a commitment that he was not willing to offer. It was enough that she had the trust of the Duke she loved. "And you are my only man," she thought to herself. She dared not let the sisterhood know about the baby boy she carried in her womb. Not until it was too late for them to interfere. Mohiam had given her explicit instructions, without explaining the Bene Gesserit's grand plans for the daughter Jessica had been ordered to bear. But Leto wanted another son so badly. After the funeral, she would tell him she was pregnant, and no more. He deserved to at least know that, so that he could hope for another son. As they drifted away from the rising flames on the funeral barge, Duke Leto felt determination strengthen his heart. Though he believed in Jessica, trusted and deeply loved her, he had too many scars from the tragedies, and knew he must always maintain a dignified distance. His father had taught him this, that an Atreides duke always lived in a different world from his women. As the leader of a great house, Leto's primary obligation was to his people, and he could not allow himself to get too close to anyone. "I am an island," he thought. This concludes the reading of Dune, House Harkonnen, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. This book was read by Michael Pritchard.